when I landed in a dream. I've been so used to losing, ain't nobody more surprised than me. I turned and faced the fire that's been burning there forever. I let it burn all the way, singing Amazing Grace, left my heart light as a feather. And made me strong as steel.
That was Geneva Magnus with Strong.
You are tuned to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, when we share a wide variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music with you from 5:30 to 7 a.m. Each week, your hosts Dan Schrammack and Stephen Morrison bring you some of our favorite new releases and plenty of vintage favorites. It's a great way to start your Fridays, discover some new music, and find out about shows and festivals coming to the area. You can also find show playlists and listen to archive shows on demand via our website at kboo.fm and also via our free mobile app. That's the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, where you hear a variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music from 5:30 to 7, right here on KBOO. We hope you'll join us.
Hello, I'm your host, Donald Altman, and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join us for a visit with leaders in personal and cultural transformation. The world is greatly in need of caregivers, caregivers for the sick, the infirm, the abused, and so on. Traditionally, we think of caregivers as our doctors, nurses, therapists, first responders, and so on. But we can expand those traditional caregiving categories to include the ordinary people who offer love, nurturing, guidance, and mentoring to those in need. This could be someone looking after an ill spouse, adult children taking care of aging parents, and parents raising their own children. And of course, teachers, friends, and benefactors of all kinds who open their hearts to assist those in need. But there's another side to caregiving, the side that's not always talked about, and that's the devastating burnout that many caregivers experience. Over time, it's not uncommon for caregivers to have feelings of depression, exhaustion, hopelessness, and even loss of joy. Some try to escape the pressure of caring, even if it means escaping to an addictive behavior. To help explore the topic of keeping caregivers emotionally healthy and balanced is Jan Chosen Bays, MD. Jan is an ordained Zen teacher and pediatrician who for 30 years specialized in the evaluation of children for abuse and neglect. She has trained in Zen for 45 years with Roshis Taizan Miyazumi and Shoto Harada Roshi. Her husband, Hogan Bays, with him, she serves as co-abbot of the Great Vow Monastery. a residential center for intensive Zen training in Clatskanie, Oregon. Jan has published articles in the medical literature and articles about Zen in Tricycle and Buddha Dharma magazines. Jan is also the author of several books, including Mindful Eating, a guide to rediscovering a healthy and joyful relationship with food, and that's been translated into 10 languages, How to Train a Wild Elephant and Other Adventures in Mindfulness, The Vow-Powered Life, Simple Methods for Living on Purpose, Jizo Bodhisattva, Guardian of Children, Women, and Other Voyagers, Mindfulness on the Go, Simple Meditation Practices You Can Do Anywhere, and her most recent book, Mindful Medicine, 40 Simple Practices to Help Healthcare Professionals Heal Burnout and Reconnect to Purpose. Well, it's an honor and a pleasure to have Jan Schozenbays here with us today. Hello, Jan, and welcome to the Pathways Show.
Hi, Donald. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, it's an honor to have you here, and I wanted to tell our audience, I just loved your Mindful Medicine book, and the book is targeted for those in the medical fields, but it's filled, in my opinion, with great practices anyone can use. Did you see this as a book that really anyone can use for ordinary caregivers?
Well, I think you're right. You know, when my mother was taking care of my grandmother, who was 100 years old and had dementia, a book came out called The 72-Hour Day. Mm. And that was the first book I ever saw about the burnout that happens when you're a caregiver.
That's an interesting title. Yeah, that's an interesting title. Did it refer to just that the day seemed so long?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, and that burnout, especially for, you worked with abused children, I think it was at the Legacy.
Yes, Legacy Emmanuel.
Mm-hmm. Legacy Emmanuel here in Portland area, the Children's Hospital. I didn't realize that you were the medical director there. How did you personally experience burnout? How did you know that this was happening even to you?
Sure. Well, I had been the medical director for about 10 years at the CARES program, the Child Abuse Response and Evaluation Services program at Legacy Emmanuel. And, you know, we had worked up to seeing between 100 and 120 children for abuse each month. And that's a lot of suffering coming through your door and hearing it from children who describe it so vividly, you know, what's happened to them. And I'm very resilient. I came from a very loving family, and I was doing fine until something happened in my personal family, and that's often kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back. Mm-hmm. So my father died. And then my spiritual teacher, my Zumi Roshi, also died. And one evening I was going home late, which is kind of usual because a rape case had come in late. But I found myself, I heard a kind of sappy country western song on the radio, and I suddenly burst into tears and I started crying, and I thought, I'm not sure I can stop. And I realized that there was a well of human suffering that had accumulated in my heart that was now overflowing, and that I needed to do something about it. And then I started reading about burnout and realized, oh, I was suffering from burnout. I had all the signs and symptoms, physical and emotional exhaustion, depression, you know, the joy had gone out of my day and my work. And I'm usually a very Pollyanna-ish type person. Depersonalization, that was the feeling of, oh no, not another whatever case. You know, couldn't they see them in the emergency room? Couldn't I see them next week? And then doubt in professional efficacy is another symptom of burnout, where you just begin to wonder, am I really making a difference?
Well, sure, with this flood of suffering coming through your door, you wonder, right?
Yes. And you start to despair for humankind, too. Mm.
Well, that's pretty challenging to have to face that. So Mindful Medicine as an organization, can you maybe share a little about how that came about? And then where did you get the idea for the book?
Sure. Well, what I realized when I diagnosed myself with burnout and read about it and began teaching about burnout is that the only solution really is what we'd call a spiritually based solution. That if you're going to regain your joy in life and your sense of purpose in life, it needs a spiritual foundation. It doesn't matter what spiritual foundation. And of course, I had my Zen training and my Zen practice, but I realized I needed to increase the dose to match the dis-ease. And so I dropped back to 3/4 time so that I could do more meditation, because I couldn't have survived doing the medical work in child abuse without my meditation practice, but I needed to be doing more.
Well, it's interesting to think about our spiritual practices as a dose.
Yes.
Mostly having to, take 2 of these meditations a day.
Yeah. 30 minutes a day. No, maybe you need 35 minutes a day. So then I began teaching about burnout. So I did trainings for people like DHS workers for the state, mm-hmm. and for physicians and nurses about burnout. Because, we lose a lot of physicians and nurses to suicide. You lose more than 1 a day in the U.S.
That kind of shocked me that you had some statistics about that in your book, and I was really kind of stunned at the severity amount of that.
It's incredible. It's 2 to 3 graduating classes of doctors or nurses per year lost to suicide. And it used to be, when I was first in medicine, that a lot of physicians, the majority, recommended a medical career to their children, but it's changed. And recently, the survey showed that 70% of physicians don't recommend that their children go into medicine. So that's pretty sad.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a meditation group, and there are 2 mindfulness-based stress reduction teachers in that group. And they were approached by some physicians at Providence Hospital in Portland, who had taken mindfulness-based stress reduction and found it so helpful for their own symptoms of burnout.
Mm.
One person said, "It saved my career. I was ready to quit." So they began doing weekend retreats for healthcare professionals,
mm-hmm.
Teaching them various techniques of meditation, and then also some simple practices. And I became a teacher in those retreats too. And then eventually we just started this group that meets once a week on Wednesday nights called Mindful Medicine.
Yeah. I've actually sat in on a couple of those, and it's I really enjoyed it. How do most physicians, who are very often very concrete in how they approach things, how do you find that they've adapted or embrace this idea of meditation and mindfulness?
Well, it's wonderful to have lived long enough that you become mainstream. So I had these 2 parallel careers as a meditation teacher and also as a physician. But at the beginning, in the 70s, when I was in medical school and training, you didn't tell anybody that you meditated. It was considered woo-woo and really suspect. But I found 2 or 3 other people who had meditation practices in the hospitals where I worked. And we would pass each other in the halls and kind of whisper, like, "How was your retreat? And how was your meditation going?" And then gradually, it became something that people accepted, instead of being weird. And so then we were considered pioneers, and now it's like mainstream. And the research is abundant that mindfulness and meditation are extremely helpful for healthcare professionals, and specifically for symptoms of burnout.
Yeah, and I think that's important for people to be able to know that there's a body of research behind that. One of the things, your book, you've got a whole section of connecting with yourself with this number of different practices, and you started off with one of them is mindful self-compassion, and I thought that was really important. Can you explain for our audience what is mindful self-compassion, why can it help nourish us and help reverse burnout?
Sure. Well, we tend, especially in the helping professions, or when we're giving endlessly and not taking care of ourselves, which is characteristic of people in the healthcare professions or first responders, and those caring, as you mentioned in your introduction, caring for others, we tend to put other people first and not take very good care of ourselves physically and also emotionally. And we also begin to consider it as selfish to take time for ourselves, to care for ourselves, that other people need this care more than we do. But it turns out that mindful self-compassion, which has been developed over about the last 10 years as an active practice, is extremely helpful once you can convince people to do it. That we need to, you know, the classic saying is you need to fill up your own tanks before, to overflowing, actually, before you can actually have enough to keep generating compassion and love for other people.
Yeah.
And the research, again, is amazing. There are hundreds of research papers now on the efficacy of mindful self-compassion.
Yeah. So mindful self-compassion, is that basically showing kindness to yourself?
Yeah. So the same, we actually had our mindful medicine group last night, and the person who led the meditation said, think of your awareness, your love like a spotlight, and you pick somebody that you really love, and you shine that spotlight on that person, and you can feel your love and compassion flowing through that spotlight, or that heart-to-heart connection. Sometimes I imagine a tube between my heart and, let's say, somebody else's heart, like your heart, and through that flows that feeling of warmth and compassion. Then, she said, turn that back on yourself and let that kindness and compassion flow back into you. Another way to think of it is like a warm liquid that fills you up from the toes up, just gradually fills you up to overflowing, and fuels you for the work that you're doing.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's a really wonderful metaphor, a way to think of it as a spotlight. And yeah, we need to shine that light inwardly and on ourselves as well. You had an interesting, what you called your algebra for suffering. I never heard suffering described as an algebraic formula before, but I'd like you to share that with our audience. I thought that was a wonderful way to look at it.
Sure. So if there's N amount of suffering in the world, and we suffer because of that, then there's now N plus one amount of suffering in the world. So we've only added to the suffering in the world, which is not our intent. Nobody has the intent to add to suffering in the world unless, you know, they have some strange mental illness where they do want to increase the suffering in the world. But ordinarily, we want to help relieve people's unhappiness and suffering. So we would like to have it be N minus one, if we can.
Yeah.
If we can take care of our own suffering and then work in whatever place we do. You know, it doesn't have to be healthcare. Everybody has their place in the world where they're helping other human beings. Like every time the person comes to collect the garbage at the monastery where I live, you know, we have a big dumpster because we do a lot of retreats. And I'm just so grateful that that person comes every week and takes all that away so that it doesn't accumulate here and cause disease. You know, or people who direct traffic, or the clerk in, you know, checkout clerk in the store. You know, just to realize how many people are constantly part of our lives and helping.
Yeah. So that's having instead of focusing on the negatives, having gratitude, right? Kind of open yourself up.
Yeah, gratitude is a hugely powerful practice.
You know, I was once invited to, I think it was Providence, Portland, to talk to some residents, some people who were just starting their medical careers. And I had them do a gratitude practice, and there was after we did it, there was just stunned kind of silence in the room. And one of them said, "You mean I can think about good things? I don't have to always be, you know, because you're kind of trained as a doctor to really kind of look at all the bad things that can happen."
Correct.
Right?
And our mind is also that way. Our own mind is always looking for danger, for things that might go wrong. And so to switch that focus, because the mind thinks that's the way to protect us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Look out for potential toxins or COVID risks or whatever. And the news is filled with everything that's negative and scary. Like 90% of the articles are negative things because the news media knows that that's what our mind's interested in.
Well, it will
grab
our...
healthy for us.
Right. Yeah. It'll just grab our attention, won't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So gratitude really changes the field of our awareness. And how have you found that gratitude has, that people accept gratitude when you work with them?
Yes.
Are they open to that?
Well, you know, again, there's that feeling of, well, I don't need this, you know, I'm okay. I've got, you know, a house and I'm warm and I've got clothing and I've got loving children and so on. There's other people who need this, but we all need it. We all need it, especially when we're bombarded with negative news all day long.
One of the other, thank you for that. And I hope that our audience starts to even just look around right now and find something that you could be grateful for.
Yeah.
One of the things, there were so many things that I liked in your book, but one was the ears wide open. And you talked about something that I think we're not always aware of is how we are listening in on our world. Could you maybe expand on that a little bit?
Well, when we're caught up in our mind, and that often means caught up in negative thinking, then we're not really listening to what's going on around us. So a very lovely meditation is just to stop for a moment. For example, you know, people in the hospital are always washing their hands.
Oh, right, yeah.
Washing or sanitizing their hands. So you take something that you have to do many times a day, and you turn that into a mindfulness practice, which helps you just clear the heart mind for the next thing that's coming, or the next patient, or the next duty. So you as you're washing your hands, you can open your awareness to all the sounds around you. Let the mind be clear, and then just listen. First for the obvious sounds, and then for the more subtle sounds.
What are some of those more subtle sounds that maybe we don't often notice?
Well, you can start by listening to your own body, so you can listen to your breath. You can even hear, you know, the digestive system working sometimes. Some people can hear their heart beating.
How interesting.
Yeah.
It's almost entering a different world, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's a soundscape. It's like music. I'd say that it's like landing on a foreign planet and you hear this weird music. And you don't know what's producing it. You're just listening to it as like an unusual concert.
Oh, that's really taking off the filters, isn't it? The mental filters, and just hearing things as they arise.
Yes.
In the moment. And that makes me think about when we're listening, we have to enter a place of silence. Would you say that helps us connect with silence in some way?
Yes, it's switching from the thinking mind to the awareness mind. And to do that, our mind has to be clear and quiet. Now, we're used to that. When we were infants, of course, we didn't have any thought, and so we were just pure awareness. And then each of us has had peak moments, which if you reflect on them, are moments when the mind just stopped talking. And you entered some moments of pure awareness, like watching a beautiful sunset, or your firstborn child, or as someone was dying. And we call those peak moments, but we don't have to wait for them to happen. If we do our practice, our meditation and our mindfulness practice, then we increase the frequency of those moments of pure presence. which are so nourishing to us.
And that pure presence reminds me of something else in your book. That pure presence is kind of devoid of outrage and anger and a sense of righteousness. And you talked about anger in a way I think is very helpful, as it kind of being the messenger, but to actually be effective in the world, we don't want to have to use that outrage to get things done.
No. Anger is the messenger that something's off kilter.
Yeah.
But then we have to look deeper and see what is off kilter and what's the best way to work with it. And anger is not the means to solve the problem. It's kind of bizarre and counterintuitive, but we have to accept things exactly as they are before we can effectively work with them. And not work with negativity, because that just breathes more negativity.
Which brings more suffering.
Yes.
Right, into the
world. To us and others.
Yeah. Our suffering can overflow onto others. You know, one of the things that I had an opportunity to be at the Great Bao Monastery, and you do a lot of wonderful programs there. I did want to mention that when I was there, I was very impressed with some of the young people who were there studying. And it's also a residential center, right? Don't you have some people who are there and training?
Yes. Currently, we have 25 people living here. Mm-hmm. And a lot of young people, because, you know, there's a disorder called failure to launch, which is kind of endemic in young people now. So we get a lot of kids who are in college or after college and just afraid to jump in to life, afraid they'll make a mistake in their first job, and then they'll end up, you know, at age 70 wondering, what did I waste my whole life? They just don't know what to do, and so we try to help them take that first step out into the world.
Well, I was very impressed to see that young people had that impulse to want to explore spiritual life, and what a wonderful way to start your life. Because have you found that, how long do people stay there? What's their general experience?
Well, people can be here from one day to 13 years. 13 years is usually we're training someone to be a teacher.
Okay.
But we have a summer program that's 6 weeks long, and right now we have, I think, 7 people here.
Wonderful.
Young people here for the summer program.
Wonderful. Before we wrap things up here, could you maybe guide us in a brief couple minute long maybe self-compassion visualization or meditation?
Sure. I'll bring in some of the themes that we talked about. So if people who are listening would be willing to do this, to just sit in a comfortable position and bring your awareness to this body that sits and breathes. So if your eyes are closed or lowered, you can't see your body. How do you know that you have a body that's sitting and breathing? And then you might bring your awareness to your lungs, wherever you feel in your body your lungs are, and however you know that they're there. Perhaps there's a sense of expansion and contraction in the chest, the ribs moving. And just bring full awareness to your lungs. And then before you move on to another part of the body, say, thank you, lungs, for, and just leave a blank and see if anything arises in that blank space or not. Thank you, lungs, for. And now let's move to feet. So if you would take the light of your awareness to your feet, to all of the sensations that tell you that you have feet. Could be sensations of touch, warmth, coolness, tingling sensation, even movement, full awareness in the feet.
Well, thank you, Jan, but we're going to have to leave it with the feet.
Okay, good.
I would love to talk longer. There's a lot more we could explore, but we've run out of time. Let's be sure to tell our listeners about your website, zendust.com, and that's spelled Z-E-N-D-U-S-T, one word, zendust.com. And that's where you can learn more about Jan's work and books. For information about her new book, Mindful Medicine, you can go to the publisher website, shambhala.com, and that's S-H-A-M-B-H-A-L-A.com, or any online bookseller. For those who tuned into the Pathway Show late, this is your host, Donald Altman, author of several books on mindfulness, including my newest, the Simply Mindful Coloring Book, and Simply Mindful, a 7-week course and personal handbook for mindful living. Information about my books, courses, and CDs can be found at mindfulpractices.com. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview wherever you want, whenever you want, via the internet or as a free podcast. Today, we've been visiting with author Jan Chosen-Bays, an ordained Zen teacher and pediatrician. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed via KBOO-FM Sunday mornings at 8:30 USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, and that's spelled D-I-V-I-Nation.com, as well as via iTunes and other free podcast servers. This is Donald Altman reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and podcasts.
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Thanks for listening to the Slavic Radio Hour on 90.7 FM KBOO. Please enjoy the next hour of Armenian music and tune in next Sunday for an hour of interviews by Armenian